continuing through Matthew, and we're to chapter 20. We've done the first part last week, and I'm going to just read the rest of the chapter from where we ended last week, and then we'll go into it. And as usual, I can't see tonight for some reason. So, now as Jesus, this is verse 17 of chapter 20. Now as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, "We are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day he will be raised to life." Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons, and kneeling down, asked a favor of him. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." "You don't know what you are asking," Jesus said to them. "Can you drink the cup I am going to drink?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." When the ten heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." As Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. Two blind men were sitting by the roadside, and when they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." The crowd rebuked them and told them to be quiet, but they shouted all the louder, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." Jesus stopped and called them. "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. "Lord," they answered, "we want our sight." Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes. Immediately they received their sight and followed him. It's interesting that Jesus is announcing the kingdom of God in ways that no one expects. If you've been around me for any length of time, you know that one of my working theories is called the upside-down kingdom. The kingdom of God is an upside-down kingdom. It's not at all like the kingdoms of this earth. It's all upside down. It's all backwards. It's all turned on its head. And if you think that what works in the kingdom of heaven will work in the kingdoms of this earth and vice versa, you're just wrong. It's just going to mess you up, because what happens is, in the kingdom of this earth, it's about power and it's about might and it's about strength and it's about showing people up and it's about getting your way and it's about, you know, doing everything in your power to do that. I was at the Good Egg restaurant having breakfast, and these two people came and sat at the table next to me, and pretty soon the server came and took their order, and the guy said thank you to her and called her by her name. And when the server had left to turn in their order, the lady that was with the guy said, "Do you know her?" And he said, "Oh, no, I don't know her at all." He says, "You know her name?" He said, "She's got a name tag." And she says, "Wow, you're really observant." And he says, "No, I found that if you call a server by their first name, you get better service. They take care of you. They put more food on the plate. They bring it out while it's hot. It's good to know their name." And I thought, wow. And I thought he liked her, you know? I thought he was going to be nice to her, but it wasn't about her at all. He didn't learn her name because he cared at all about her. He learned her name because he gets better service. He gets more of what he wants. He gets what he needs and what he thinks he has to have. He was using what seemed like intimate reality, you know, beautiful intimacy, to get what he wanted, to manipulate, to take what he wanted, and to do that. And so we look at this passage and we see just a chapter or two ago when Eric was talking about that the 12, like what we're going to get, you know, like he's talking to the disciples and there's 12 thrones and they get to sit on those thrones, and that's pretty exciting. And then we have the first part of chapter 20 where we talk about generosity and we talk about not getting what we want. We talk about everybody being treated fairly according to grace, but not fairly according to the law, and that God offers this beautiful life. And now Jesus kind of talks about how that's going to happen. And he says, we must go up to Jerusalem, what? So that I can die. So that I can lay down my life. So I can offer myself completely, fully, totally, 100%. I can lay down my life. And that's really exciting. And that's really scary. And if I were a disciple and I were sitting there, I'd go, wow. But it's kind of like that battle cry thing that you do, like when you're going to go to war and you want your soldiers to fight with you. You know, we're going to go take that hill and we may die on the way, but are you with me? And you know, and it's kind of that, it's got a lot of that macho stuff to it. That's kind of what it sounds like. Yeah, I'm with you. We're going to go with you. I don't know where I'd be if I'd be that, or I'd say, Jesus, I don't know if you really know what you're talking about. But it's really interesting is that when he says that, the mother of the sons of Zebedee, James and John, by the way, two of the disciples' mom comes to him, and it's like she's missed the whole conversation. It's like she's missed completely what Jesus is saying. And what is she into? She's into power and position. And you notice it's not about her, but it sort of is, you know? Because we do that. Well, if I, you know, I wanted to be a basketball star, obviously that didn't work out real well. And so, well, then I'll make my kids play basketball, and they'll be the greatest basketball players ever. And I'll sort of live vicariously through them, you know? If they make it to the NBA, I'll kind of feel like I did it, you know? Like somehow I arrived too, and of course that didn't work out real well. And so, you know, then we're all just kind of depressed because like we wasted a lot of time playing basketball and trying to get better at it, and it hasn't really panned out the way we thought it should or would or could. And so you see this mom who's not just in it for herself. I mean, there's some beautiful things that she offers here. First of all, she's recognizing that Jesus is a king, that Jesus has potential to be the Messiah, the one, the ruler, the one who's going to kick the Romans out, who's going to take over, and she's heard that, I'm sure by now, that whole thing about the 12 thrones, and she's pretty excited about that, but which thrones does she want for her kids? The one on the right and the one on the left, you know? I want the good thrones, you know? I don't just want some throne out there, like I don't want one of the 12, I want the right hand and the left hand for my kids. And I think she's kind of playing a card here too, because James and John are cousins of Jesus, and so that means she's a sister of Mary, and that means that she's kind of playing the family card, you know, like you kind of owe us because we're like related. And so you kind of have this sense too that there's this, I'm kind of owed here. We have to keep this in the family. There's a lot of desire for her kids to have their own position and status in this kingdom that's about to happen. Jesus' question to her when she had started this was, "What do you want?" She had come and noticed she had knelt before him. She had bowed. She had done what you do before a king. She had gotten down on her knees. And he had said, "What do you want?" And I think that's a really important question and a question you need to wrestle with. What do you really want? What do you want? Not what do you think you want? Not what have you been told you want? Not what are good things to want? But what do you actually want? And that's what she wants. She says that she wants status for her kids. And Jesus says, "You don't know what you're asking." I think that's absolutely brilliant. You don't know what you're asking. I wonder how many times when I pray, Jesus goes, "You don't know what you're asking. I don't think you really want what you say you want. I don't think you really know what you want. And I don't think I'm going to give you what it is you think you want. Matter of fact, I actually know better for you." And it's interesting that when we ask God for things and for stuff and for position and for status and for rights and for responsibilities even, that he actually hears us and that he actually knows. And that's what Jesus does. He hears this request and he processes it in the way that he's asking her very specifically, "Do you really want this?" And when she says, "This is what I want," he says, "Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink?" There's this reference to the cup is always a cup of sorrow. It's always a cup of sadness. Whenever we hear references to drinking a cup, it's a cup of sadness. It's a cup of burden. It's a cup of sorrow. And so he says, "Can you drink the cup?" And notice James and John are there. You know, like, I wonder if they were the ones who put their mom up to it. "Hey, go ask Jesus if we can be on the right and on the left." You know, like, it's not clear from Scripture what they're doing, but they're sort of jockeying for position. And later on, when we hear about the other apostles, you know, anger and indignation at what they've done, you get a good idea that everybody's kind of angling for position here, for status, for rights. And they've kind of pushed their mom forward to ask for them. And so they immediately answer, you know, now mom's history because we don't need her anymore. And they say, "Yeah, sure, we'll drink the cup. Yeah, we're ready to go into it with you. We'll go to battle with you. We'll fight. We when you're the king, we want to be right and left." And Jesus says, "You will indeed drink from the cup." In other words, he promises them that there will be sorrow and there will be sadness and there will be burdens and there will be struggle. He promises them that. He says, "You will indeed drink from the cup." This is an aside, but it's interesting that James is the first martyr of the disciples, the first one to die, and it's interesting that John is the last. And both of those things come with amazing burdens. I can't imagine John seeing one after another the death of the apostles and the horrible persecution. I can't imagine what it's like to sit on the Isle of Patmos as a prisoner at the end of your life, having seen all that and know all that and having struggled with that. It's almost as though when Jesus promises that they'll drink from the cup, they indeed do that. That it is about suffering. And then he says, "Those places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." So Jesus says, "I'm not going to promise you that. I'm only going to promise you that you will suffer." And now, of course, the rest of the disciples are really irritated. They're really angry. You're trying to get position. You're trying to get status. And they're, I imagine, plotting their own, right? We're going to get even. We're going to get ours. We got to catch up now. They've been rebuffed a little bit. Maybe here's our opportunity. And Jesus, like, calls them together and gets the whole thing stopped. And he says, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Jesus says you don't get to play the power game. You don't get to play the position and the status game. You don't get to do that. It's not for you. It's not how this kingdom works. It's not how my kingdom works. It's not how the upside down kingdom works. It's not going to be that way. You don't get that choice. You don't get to have that. You don't get to have status. That's not what this is about. And then he says, instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. It's interesting that we get the word to minister to. If you've been around the village for any length of time, you know that we're calling everybody a deacon, right? You're all ministers, a deacon. That's what you do. You're called to be a minister. You're called to minister to each other, to others. That's what we do. That's what we're calling people to. We're all deacons, diakonos, ministers, people who minister to each other. That's a really fascinating word, by the way. Diakonos, deacon, diakonos, or is really two words, and it's kind of a slamming together of two words, and it's the best translation, or the roughest, it's kind of rough, but the best translation would be to raise up dust. To raise up dust. That we're to raise up dust. Well, and it's not just, you know, doing what kids do out in a dust pile. It's raising up dust because you're sitting and waiting for the master to ask you to do something, and when the master says, do it, you scramble, you know, you're running, you're, oh yeah, we gotta go, and so you kick up dust. And that's really where we get that word, is like you're kicking up dust, you're moving quickly, you're gonna be about the business that you're supposed to be about. You're moving fast. And you're moving so fast that you actually stir up dust. So it's scrambling to your feet. You know, you're sitting there just peacefully minding your own business, and all of a sudden, the master says, do this. And you say, you bet. It's the old rule, you know, when I ask you to jump, you ask me how high on your way down. You know, it's kind of that, it's that kind of thing. And so for us, that means that we're to be attentive. We're to be that attentive to each other. We're supposed to be looking to each other all the time, saying, what do you need? What do you want? What do you need? What do you want? We're spending our time and our lives looking deeply at each other, caring about each other, and saying, what do you want? And then we scramble to give that, to honor that, to be like Jesus as a servant. He lays down his life. He actually physically offers his life. Some people say, well, he was killed. No, he's not. He offers his life. It's a gift. He gives it, and he says, here is my offering to you. And it's that sense that we offer to each other. We're always offering ourselves to each other. The Psalm 123 says this, I lift up my eyes to you, to you whose throne is in heaven, as the eyes of slaves look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maid looks to the hand of her mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God till he show us his mercy. Have mercy on us, O Lord, have mercy on us, for we have endured much contempt We have endured much ridicule from the proud, much contempt from the arrogant. In this upside-down kingdom, we are to be attentive, like we look to the hand of God for the slightest movement. Those who had slaves would sit in their room and they would raise a finger, and raising a finger meant bring me food or get my bed ready or get the chariot ready, or, you know, just a movement of a finger would send everybody scrambling, because now the master of the house wants something done and we need to be aware of what that is and we need to work that out. And so there's that sense in which we're constantly that way with God, that we're always looking to the hand of God saying, what would you have me do? How would you have me serve? What do you want from me? So that idea of being a slave, of being a servant, is, by the way, not a position of power. It's not a position of authority. It's not a position where you get what you want. And matter of fact, it's kind of that position where you're going to be sort of mistreated. You're going to be misused. You don't have, the owner of the house isn't really interested if you're tired or if, you know, you're having a bad hair day or whatever the thing is that's going on with you. It's just the master of the house says, jump, you move, and you move quickly. And it's interesting that we are slaves and that we're servants, that we're put into that category, that if we are disciples and followers of Jesus, we become servants and slaves. Now, we are servants and slaves of an incredibly, amazingly good master. A master who loves us, a master who actually purchases us from real slavery and buys us and then does that to set us free. And so our jumping to the task is not an obligation, a requirement. It's not a legal thing. It's not a law. It's an opportunity. It's a privilege. It's a joy. So how do we become slaves that are pleasing, servants that are pleasing? And what's that about? Like, how do we become those kind of people that are quick to see, quick to move, to help each other? By the way, what you do towards each other is what you do towards God. Don't pretend that you can separate those two. Some people say, well, I'm just serving God, but they never serve the people around them. Then you're not serving God. There are people who think that, well, I'm just doing this for God. Doing what for God? You're not really doing anything for God that doesn't involve doing for others. It is offering yourself for others. You can't separate those two. Jesus says that what you do to the least of these, my brothers, you do to me. If you offer a cup of cold water in my name, right? If you offer anything, if you clothe people who are naked, if you provide housing, if you rescue those who are in prison, whatever you do with that intent, you're doing it for me. You can't separate those two, so don't try to tear those from each other. You can't. Offering yourself to each other. So these disciples are sitting there in a room, and we're sitting here tonight in a room, and we're saying, okay, now how do I do that? Like, how do I jump to help those around me, to be there for others around me, to... Well, the first thing is you actually have to think about each other. Like, you have to have each other on your mind. You have to be aware of each other. It's not like there's just some universal needs and you go meet universal needs and then that solves the problem. You actually have to be aware of each other, and to be aware of each other requires being in each other's presence. It requires being near each other, around each other, in each other's lives. so that you can do what? Study each other. It's interesting that the slave that looks to the hand of the master, or the maid who looks to the hand of her mistress, they are so incredibly aware of what the master wants, of what the mistress wants. They're so incredibly aware, because why? It will cost them their life, you know, quite frankly, if the master's mean or the mistress is mean, it could cost them their life if they don't talk to. And it's that picture, without the legal stuff, but it's that picture of attentiveness. So that if you're a good slave and you're a good servant and you're smart, you are constantly observing. You're constantly observing the people that you would serve. And because this is an upside down kingdom, because it's not hierarchical in that way, you're basically watching the other slaves and the other servants, right? I mean, we're all slaves and servants if we're followers of Jesus. And so we're all looking to each other, and we're looking to meet the needs of each other. So that first awareness, first that there's awareness, and then there's a studying of each other. It's not just an awareness like, well, you know, I hear, you know, that Rod's going through some bad times, or I hear that Jeff's struggling, does anybody know what's going on with him? No, we're actually aware of what's going on because we're asking into each other's lives, because we're looking into each other's lives, because we actually do care. Now, that has to be motivated by love. That doesn't, in this upside-down kingdom, that's not going to be motivated by law. It's not a requirement. It's going to be motivated by love. So one of the things to do is to check and see, do I love as I've been loved? Do I really love? Like, do I care if Jeff is struggling? Does it really matter if Jeff is struggling? Does anybody care if Jeff is struggling? You know? Like, and don't get me wrong, it is impossible to carry all the burdens of this room on one pair of shoulders. Trust me, I have very sinfully tried to do that in the past, right? It is not my job to carry every burden in this room. It is my job to be aware of the people that God puts near me. And it is very important that we all do that. And it is also very important to look at those people who we all miss. And to just be aware of that. To be aware of who they are. To ask into their lives. So there's an awareness, there's a looking into, there's a studying. Then there's the motivation to creatively offer them. What do you want, by the way, is a great question to ask. Have you ever noticed that people give you gifts that you couldn't possibly want? Like, it's just the stupidest, like, what were they thinking? You know? You get married, and people buy you wedding presents, and you go, people, what were you thinking? Like, I wouldn't put that anywhere in my house. And then you gotta, you know, then they come over, and you gotta, you know, and it's hanging out in the garage, and so you gotta bring it in for the day so that you're not embarrassed. It's just that whole, like, what were you thinking? Like, did you even think about me? You know? It's like buying me a, you know, jockey uniform, you know, because I like horses and horse racing. You know, it's like, what are you thinking? You know, that's just stupid. It's not going to work. It's not what I need. It's not. So it's good to ask, what do you want? What do you want? I remember when I was a kid, the neighbor kids, and this really dates me, so there's like maybe one person in this room or two. Oh, we got some visitors, so maybe three or four that will actually remember this. But when I was a kid, slot car racing was a big thing, and everybody had these slot car race sets, right? And they were little, you put the tracks together, you could put them together in all cool different ways, and then you had your own little race cars, and people modified their race cars, and there were slot car, like, places you could bring your slot cars and race. I always wanted a slot car race set. I wanted it so bad, but we were broke and poor, and we never could afford it, so I just never got a slot car race set, and it kind of irritated me. And so years later, my mother-in-law says to me, "What did you want when you were a kid?" And I said, "You know, I always wanted a slot car race set. I just never got one." And she said, "Well, that's just horrible." The next Christmas, I'm opening my presents, and I get a slot car race set, man. And I take this huge piece of plywood, and I put it out on our back porch, and I build this whole thing, and I get my kids out there, and they could care less about it, you know, but I'm out there racing against myself, you know, and I'm having a ball, and I'm thinking, you know, this is such a great set. If Steve and Dave and the O'Brien boys, and if they could see me now, you know, because I have what I've always, you know, what did I want? Well, I did want a slot car race set. What did I really want? Is that really what I wanted? No, I wanted to be accepted and loved by my peers is what I really wanted. Now, don't get me wrong. I love that slot car race set. Matter of fact, I think I still have it. I should probably set it up again. But what did I really want? I think that when we go to people and go to each other, that's a question we should ask. And we should be so aware of them and so engaged with them that we can see that maybe it's not a slot car race set. Maybe it's acceptance. Maybe it's love. Maybe it's compassion. Maybe it's understanding. Maybe it's a conversation. Maybe it's dinner. Who knows? Like, what you want is a legitimate question to ask, and it's a question you should ask. And by the way, when somebody asks you, "What do you want?" be honest. Because a lot of times we're sort of embarrassed by the things that we want and that we really long for. We kind of feel like when my mother-in-law said, "What do you really want?" It's like, yeah, that's what I always wanted. It's kind of embarrassing, you know, when you're 30 years old and you're into slot car racing. But it was what I wanted. But it wouldn't have come my way. It wouldn't have been offered if I simply hadn't have said, "This is what I want. This is what I like. This is something I enjoy. This is something I take pleasure in." And so we're called to do that, to be honest with each other. There's a thing about not only saying what we want, but then being aware, completely aware of what the person needs. Because a lot of times our wants are connected to our needs, but they're not always. And a lot of times what happens is we don't, to be aware of where the need is. I remember when I lost my job, I walked away from a company. I had been, you know, people said, "Well, we heard you're doing pretty well, and we saw that you got a new vehicle." So financially, they assumed that I was doing okay and that we were surviving and doing all right, and they were right. But they didn't know what I needed. What I needed was someone to say, "I understand what it's like to be unemployed. It's horrifying. It's scary. It's not fun to be unemployed. It's awful. It's fearful." What I wanted was somebody who'd been there, or somebody who could understand, who would just let me talk about my fear, who would say, "It's probably not going to be okay, or maybe it will be, but either way, I'm with you, and I'll sit with you, and we'll walk this path together." Like, my longing was to have that. But people saw that, you know, we didn't appear to have great financial need, and therefore it was okay. They had missed what was really going on. I remember the person who came and said, "It must be awful to not have a job." I see his face still. He is one of my closest and dearest friends and will always be. Why? Because he knew me. because he knew what I needed. He knew what I longed for. He was aware, and he sat with me, and he wept with me, and he was scared with me, and he was angry at the system with me, and he let me rant and rave and scream and curse, and he didn't write me off, and he just walked with me and said, I'm here. Sometimes he just sat for hours and listened. So be aware not of just what people say they want, but also what they need, what they really need, and what they really what they're really asking for. That requires looking beneath the words often, and it requires an awareness of the person, and it requires empathy, not sympathy, but empathy. Empathy is that act by which you put yourself in someone else's place. When you hear of things happening in people's lives that are scary, imagine how you would feel if you were them. And think that through. The other thing that we often give, we do when we try to meet people's needs is that we make it about us. We think we have like certain things that we can offer, and so we just offer those things without being sensitive to the person that's sitting there. I see the times that I've done that where I have this particular. I assume that everyone must feel the way I feel about a certain thing, and so I offer that. Because it's about me. I make it about me and not about the person. Laying down our lives. I don't think, probably, hopefully, anyone in this room will ever have to lay down their life for someone else. But, and that's certainly my prayer, but we are to lay down our lives each day, which is not to give someone what we want to give them, not to do that in the sense of, and I'm not going to make this real clear. I'm not making it real clear. Be careful that when you offer, it doesn't come with strings attached. It doesn't obligate the recipient. That's what I'm trying to say. So that what I really want is relationship with Eric, so I go over to Eric's and I offer him relationship, and I try to make it pretend that it's all about him. It's not about him. It's about me needing relationship with Eric. And so I go offer false friendship, really. I don't offer real friendship. I offer false friendship because I'm not thinking about him. I'm thinking about my own longing, my own need, and my own desire for relationship. Does that make sense? We often do that. We don't give freely. We give in a way that obligates. Don't give of yourself in a way that obligates the person. I just heard a matter of fact, Eric was telling me about someone who had come to their house and simply trimmed the tree for them and then left, and how much that had meant to him. And I just thought, what a great story. Because here was someone who very selflessly gave of themselves their time and their energy and their effort, did something and didn't demand to be noticed, didn't take up, you know, Eric's time to do it, didn't make demands on Eric, just gave freely. That's the kind of gift that I'm talking about. That when we look to each other's needs and we meet each other's wants and desires and needs, that we're doing that not in a way that we get glory and credit and position and status and acknowledged as really good people. This sin is a really invasive sin, and maybe it just is for me. I don't know, but this it's easy for me to do that, to want something so much that I offer it falsely in hopes of getting it back. But when you genuinely offer, when you genuinely offer, there's something beautiful that happens, because what happens is it feels like dying. It feels like death. Because when we offer out of our emptiness, and when we offer out of our own longing, and when we offer out of our own wanting and desire, it feels like we're dying. Because if I have to give and I don't have anything left to give, and really what I do, I want is to be cared for and noticed and loved and all those things that we long for, that's what I really want. But if I give that freely, not under obligation, again, remember this is not about law, this is grace, this is the upside down kingdom, when I offer that, there's sometimes that fear that I'll never get what I want. I'll never have it. No one will ever ask me. No one will ever care about me. And that's where our demands instantly come in. So when we do that, when we're offering ourselves that way, it is really laying down our lives. It is really dying to what we think we have to have. And that's the hardest thing. But there's this really cool thing. It's called resurrection. It's called resurrection. That when we die, we're resurrected. When we die, we're resurrected. And that happens not only at the end of our life, and because of Jesus' most amazing gifts, that will happen for those of us who believe. We will be resurrected. We will be made new. We will, I don't know what that's all going to look like. It's going to be fantastic. We will be resurrected. But even in that daily dying to ourselves and offering ourselves to others, when that feels like death, it is death. It feels like it because it is, right? It's dying to our own needs and desires and wants. There's something beautiful that happens. God resurrects us. He lifts us up. He sends other slaves and servants to us. As we are servant and slave of someone else, servants and slaves come and minister to us. There are people so attentive to us that they see a twitch of our finger and they say, ah, they need something. They want something. I'll raise some dust and get it for them. I'm scrambling. To walk in that trust is really hard. And it's where we live. I like when the blind men to say what they want. Jesus says, what do you want? What do you want me to do? And they say, give us our sight. Let us see. That's what we want. That's what I want. It's real clear. We want our sight. The great sign of the Messiah, one of the curses of the culture was that if you were blind, you were nothing. And there's no recorded healings of blind people in the Old Testament. It just didn't happen. Because one of the signs of the Messiah was that blind people would see. And so they do. And so they do. It says immediately they received their sight. Why? Because Jesus had compassion on them. And he touched their eyes. You cannot even begin to touch the amazing amount of compassion and love and tenderness in that touch. That word is about a very gentle, loving touch. And Jesus touches them, and they see, and their response is to follow, to become disciples, slaves, servants, people who are looking constantly at a moving finger, looking to the eyes. Comments, questions, thoughts, ideas. pushbacks? And often we don't dare say what we really want, even when we do know. Comments? Right. To ask someone what they want obligates, feels like an obligation, but you're right. I mean, we can't always offer what we don't have, what it takes. But I think we actually do to meet the real longings and the real needs and the real...
It strikes me that when we do something out of our way to help somebody else, we feel like we deserve special dispensation. Because, look, I'm going on my way. I'm helping somebody. Your Jesus is marching off to his death and stops to help somebody.
Amazing,
and
isn't
it's
it?
It's like, you know, that's not what I would have done. Look, I'm going to go die for you. Isn't that enough?
Right. Which is...
yeah, exactly.
Right. Yes. It's just that bargaining. We turn it into transactional very quickly. Any other comments?
I think what you're inviting into is vulnerability and danger into the weakness of the vulnerability of community. Then if I tell you what my needs are, then I'm more vulnerable to being misunderstood or missed. The dynamic of our kids is very frightening for us to face what we really want, because so we have to face the possibility that if I speak it out loud, no one will want to work. Or that when my needs are put on the table, the one perspective that has been missed in my childhood, that you will see me the way I see me, and you will feel about me the way you feel about me. That there's a nakedness in telling you what.
Absolutely. And it's that vulnerability that makes us look away, right? Because if I look hard at you, you will look hard at me. If I know your needs, or if you know my needs, then it's obligation. It obligates us to love. It really does. But it's an obligation of grace and love, not of law. And I think so much of what we've done has turned it into legal, you know, like we talked about legal fairness last week. It's not legal fair. It wasn't legally fair. It's graciously fair. God is graciously fair, and He's gracious in that. But you're right. It's not. It feels like death because it is death, right? It is a dying. When I put my longing out there, it may not get met, and then I'm vulnerable again, and then I'm in pain again. It may not. But there's something powerful about that dying, and there is something powerful about the resurrection that comes out of dying. Let's pray. Father, thank you that you sent your Son and that He laid down His life, became vulnerable and was rejected and scorned and mocked, laughed at, and set His face toward Jerusalem not because of some death wish, because life was hard, not out of depression, but because he wanted to offer it to us, to me, to the people gathered here. Father, help us to be eager to look to the hands of our fellow slaves and servants, and to look to your hand, the hand of our Master, and to offer ourselves to each other. Help us to do that. I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. In response, we have offering baskets somewhere. Here they are. If you brought an offering, feel free to share that.